and today that shows up in the scene. Sort of the closest thing to an organizing theme that we have here. So we'll see in a second exactly what I've sort of structured most of this around. So I'll talk a bit about the possibility of galaxy cluster surveys, but I think from Amber's talk yesterday and even Olivier's talk today, then you can see that there's some issues there that are not obviously resolved. Now I'll talk a bit about fine-scale CMB anisotropy. So this next generation of experiments is really hammering from L of about the first peak up to L of several thousand. And it's pretty amazing what a huge leap we've done in CMB. And so one of the things that I think is not fully appreciated, so just to give you an example, so the South Pole Telescope, when it's up and running and everything's working the way it's supposed to, every month, over 10% of the sky will be sample variance limited. We'll survey the sky out to about L, over the primary CMB range, they'll measure the CMB, and then they're like, okay, well, I guess we can measure it again. But there won't be any new science in the power spectrum, which is pretty amazing. Like, okay, what now?
Variable radiance.
Which film?
What was that?
What is that?
Up to L of about 2,000. About 10%, 4,000 square feet. You sort of say what the scan speed is. And so there's cross-linking issues. It turns out they won't measure all the modes. And so it's not perfect, but there'll be no point in SPT doing any more primary CMB science once it's up and rolling after about 2 months. Everything else is making sure everything's in line, checking out the point sources, doing foregrounds, doing secondary anisotropy. The primary CMB is very soon, the temperature is just done. There's almost nothing left to be done in primary CMB temperature anisotropy. So if someone says they want to build a CMB temperature probe, they're crazy. So one of the future things is polarization. And so Amber talked about some of this polarization yesterday. And so I'm going to go a little ways into the future and say some of the sort of fun things you can do with this polarization. Because it does, it lets you do some funny things. And it's hard, because it's really hard to measure this polarization. But it gives you some interesting angles. So just for orientation, so here's something, this is many, many years old, but it turns out it's actually still fairly accurate. In the sense that there are lots of experiments coming in here, but not really. So here's the CMB power spectrum, there's the primary stuff. So WMAP is sort of crapping out somewhere around here. Planck is going to get down here, and then these big bolometer experiments, ACT, SPT, APEX, they're sort of somewhere down here. Roughly speaking, we're getting out to L of several thousand at some number of microkelvin. So this number goes up and down depending on how well these experimentalists can build their stuff. And then Amper should be somewhere in here, although in yesterday's talk, she was actually up.
We'll see where we are. Not making any comments. What was up there was not us. What was up there was previous work, and I'm just saying we are measuring in that regime.
Okay. Well, hopefully Amper will get down to here, and that means up here will be a little bit here. So what this thing is right here is the first largest secondary anisotropy, which is the thermal Snyder's ocean. So this is just pumping up scattering by hot electrons. And then down by about an order of magnitude in temperature is the what I call the Vishniac effect, or the Ostreicher-Vishniac effect, or the kinetic Snyder's effect. And it has lots of names. It's also known as Thompson scatter. you have electrons moving, and if you have Thompson scattering on moving electrons, then you get the red shifts and blue shifts. And it's down here, and it's sort of at about a microkelvin. And so this is where people are aiming to get to, and that's going to be done.
But aren't there lots of other secondary things which are much higher in amplitude than that?
Like what?
I don't know. But usually there's tons of curves on this.
So there are point sources. There are radial point sources.
What about lensing? Do you have lensing
If only.
The cluster is.
The kinetic SC, what's it dominated by? Sorry.
Well, there's two aspects. So one is, so this part down here, so it depends what L you're talking about. Sort of down here, it's actually dominated mainly by stuff near the redshift of reionization, and it's just sort of all floats. So you have these electrons, and there's clumpiness in the electrons, because there's density inhomogeneities, and they're moving according to linear theory. And so that gives you some net redshifting and blue shifting when it scatters the CMB. Down here, there's actually a nonlinear enhancement down here. And it's actually a an unresolved question, which is exactly how big this signal is down around here. And that's coming mainly from clusters at lower redshift. So there's sort of a transition, and it turns out to be right around here, right about where people will be measuring. So if they ever measure. So something interesting is that if you sort of take ALMA, something that I think is not really very well appreciated is that ALMA is this, you know, what is, I don't know what the number is now, but it's something like 60 telescopes that are very, very large, like 12-meter dishes, 60 telescopes. That's a lot of collecting area. And so if you just sort of point at some spot in the sky, it turns out ALMA can get down to this sensitivity level, about 2 microkelvin in an hour. So you stare at some spot in the sky, and you're like, oh, 2 microkelvin, that's pretty good. Whereas these other experiments, you know, it just takes a long time to get down there. But the problem with ALMA is that you're taking all your collecting area and you're focusing in one spot. So you can't do a very big expanse of sky. But if all you want to do is know what the microwave sky looks like in a fairly small area at high sensitivity, ALMA is going to be amazing. And it's nominally getting built.
So does it have the right frequencies? Or?
Yeah. It's got... I mean, they're talking about extending it all the way down to interesting radio, you know, almost a radio. You know, so it's generally millimeter stuff, but they have CMB bands, so it's not a problem in that sense. But, you know,
I think one of the projects is to measure the QDR, to measure these velocities.
I'm sure it is. Yeah. So the only problem is that it, even for galaxy clusters, ALMA has too small a field of view. The galaxy clusters, you see a CMB map, and this is, these are the little dots, I'll show you in a second. So the ALMA field of view at reasonable frequencies is generally something like, you know, smaller than an arcnet or something like that. So you're really zooming in on the center, so it's even hard to measure clusters. What you really want, so it's not ideal. If you were building a CMB experiment, you would not build ALMA, but you know, they didn't ask. So something I'm involved with, and so this is sort of the reason that I'm generally thinking about secondary anisotropies is I've now been sucked into the SPT collaboration. McGill is the only Canadian partner in this, so Matt Dodds is one of the electronics guys. So that's why it's natural for me. So it's a huge collaboration. It's, most of it's at Chicago. Big collaboration. What is it? And this is all I'm going to say about it. So what is it? Well, there it is. It's at the South Pole, and it's a telescope. So it's a 10-meter off-axis Gregorian telescope, which apparently you can see if you just look at this. That's obviously an off-axis Gregorian. I'm sure the inflation guys all know. So here's the focal point. So here are all the little millimeter wedges. So 960 elements. That's how many little things there are going to be in there. Each one of those is staring at some spot in the sky, some stuff going on I don't understand. So the important thing to realize is that it's a 10-meter telescope and that each resolution element is going to be something like an arcminute. So each one of these things is looking at, so there's actually 960 little pixels in here. And each one of these pixels has about an arcminute and it's looking at sort of a roughly a 1 arcminute patch of the sky, and there's roughly 1,000. And so it means that in a single exposure, so it's almost like a little sort of mini CCD, except instead of being the shape whatever CCDs are, it's in this shape. But it's something like a 1,000 element CCD is one way to think about it. And this is the reason CMB science has advanced so much is because now we're in this region. So let's see. So this is a simulated SE sky. Let's go forward. So, right. So there's the CMB according to WMAP1. If you were to take some little patch of it and zoom in on it 2x2, what you would see is you see this large-scale splotchiness. So these are splotches, that's the primary stuff. All of these little dots are the thermal Sagnyavsky Dobich effect. So these are galaxy clusters at some level. And so the brightest ones of this, you'd be able to sort of identify and say, there's a galaxy cluster. And so this is one of the primary goals.
If your telescope is at the South Pole, why are you showing us simulated data?
Oh, because the current data, well, so there's two reasons. One is that the data is in such a preliminary state that I'm not qualified to process it in a reliable way. two is that the last season of data had some, it was more of an, it turned out to be more of an engineering run for most of the season, because it's supposed to have 960, but at no point did they ever have more than maybe 400 or 300 up and running. They had some problem with the longer filter, so the throughput was down by about a factor of 50% or something. And so you just sort of add all these things up, and it turned out the sensitivity was down by a huge factor, such that you could not make a map that looked anything like this over any interesting amount of sky. So there is interesting data in the can over something which is about this size. So they were supposed to do 4,000 square degrees down to 10 micro K, and instead they did more like 10 square degrees down to a few tens of micro K. And you know, for me, for my personal view of the science, that's not an interesting area. So I'm not really super jazzed with the science yet, but there's people wailing away on it, and most of the problems have been sorted out, so it should be the case that this season there should be something like hundreds to thousands of square degrees at an interesting resolution.
Wait, hang on. They got data last season?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Lots of data.
I thought it was
going to be
down there.
Yeah, they went down there last season.
And when did it go down?
Dawn. It went down when the sun came up. And
so like a year ago now?
A year ago, last month or something. It went down there. They got built. You know, so that was a real picture of it. And yeah, they got data, they banged away, and so I'd say that in the end it was sort of a month of good data where the thing was really well understood and there was tiling some areas.
Was it one channel, or like, weren't there some problems?
Well, there's three channels, but one of them really sucks, is what it turns out. And so this is the thing, is that there's 960 elements, but it wasn't like you lost two-thirds of those globally. It turns out that there were sort of one or two bad wedges, and each one of those little wedges is one frequency array. They're all the same frequency, so. And the tendency is these wedges to go together. So, but it turns out that at this, you know, if you're not that sensitive, the multi-frequency turns out to be of no use. That basically, until you get down to the level where all these secondaries start to kick in, all you need is a single frequency. You don't actually see anything interesting in multiple frequencies until you get down to sort of 10 microvolts. And this is sort of one of the weird quirks of these things. So you lost the high frequency stuff, but it didn't really hurt you that much, because it wouldn't have helped you anyway. It's already intrinsically noisy.
So I have a really stupid question, sort of. So that figure there, I'm seeing the sort of over density, that's primary stuff, right?
Yeah, so the splotches are
the splotches primary. Is primary, yeah. And then these little dots, they're
are galaxy clusters.
So why am I seeing the little bright spots more or less always on this part?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So that's what happens depending on which stretch you use when you make an image.
It's easier to see them.
Yeah, oh. So this is using DS9 and sort of fiddling around with the stretch until I can see the, you know. So.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
So basically, the zero end turns out to be not be at the same level as the positive. So it's a little bit misleading in the sense.
So there's no correlation.
There should be no correlation.
Yeah, that's kind of the worst color scheme to use other than a rainbow. But
yeah,
that's what people already use.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, this is mainly just to get a sense of what the scales are. So this, you know, the purpose of this is to see that the galaxy clusters are this big and that the primary CMB is this big. And so what it tells you, this whole thing is 2 degrees by 2 degrees. So if you smooth this with a beam that's this big, you're in trouble. So it tells you, you know, imagine taking this spot and smoothing with a beam just this big. It tells you if your beam's this big, you're in a lot of trouble. And 2 degrees by 2 degrees, so what's that? A degree is 60 arcminutes. So you're talking about the Planck beam is sort of this big. So Planck is not going to be really resolving these things, but they have so many frequencies they can just subtract that. Yeah.
Yeah. What scales do you sort of larger structures in the universe like superclusters?
Superclusters are kind of a funny thing in that
they're fictional.
Yeah, like they're not bound, right? So supercluster is not a collection of galaxy clusters orbiting around your fork. A supercluster is, or some spot in the sky that happens to have a few galaxy clusters.
And Zwicky looked at it and said, there's a supercluster.
That's a supercluster.
But it is true that if you take an n-body simulation and you sort of look at the filaments, you know, so you take some of these boxes, and then if you take a box that's, say, 100 megaparsecs on the side, and you just look at one projection of it, and you say, mark all the positions of galaxy clusters, you see them, they concentrate at the nodes of this cosmic web. So they really do sort of concentrate where the filaments meet. You will see a few galaxy clusters over there. So what that's saying is that galaxy clusters are clusters. And when the correlation function of the galaxy clusters becomes of order 1, then that's basically a galaxy supercluster. Mm-hmm. Something like a galaxy cluster supercluster.
But it is interesting that you don't clearly see the filamentary structure.
You don't see it at all, and that's because this is the Zhang-Nagel-Dovich effect, which is integrated all along the line of sight. So most stuff, you get this luminosity weighting. But because this is just scattering the cosmic microwave background, so it's getting, the intrinsic effect is getting weaker as you go to higher redshifts, but the microwave background scales by exactly that same factor, so at higher redshift, the microwave background is brighter by the same amount. So per photon scattered, you see a lower flux, but the flux of the CMB at position of the cluster is up by that same factor, 1 plus n to the 4. So the result is that if you take the same ball of gas and take it at redshift 0.5, 1, or 2, the magnitude of the effect along a pencil beam through the cluster is always going to be the same. So the net result is that you end up stacking up everything along your line of sight. And so the fainter emission, so sort of the cosmic web with all these filaments, you stack it all on top of each other, all these filaments are all at different angles, and they just average away. So you actually can't see the cosmic web very well this way. And it's just because it doesn't have a strong enough contrast.
And it doesn't have hot gas, I guess. That's
That's
not really known.
That's the point of...
But that's not the problem. The problem, actually, is that the other stuff has hot gas. The problem, you know, there
well,
is...
not as much as...
It's down by some amount, and then there's a bunch of independent ones along the line of sight that average down. If you take some snapshot, if you take a slice of a simulation and you plot the log of the SE flux, you see the filaments. You plot the log of the SE flux. And of course, every simulation, so the simulations you were showing the log of the density. And you know what? No one measures the log of anything.
Oh,
for the most part, people measure it stuck in linear space. So when you plot something, you compare these nice logarithmic stretch things with something that's not logarithmically stretched, you can get sort of misleading plots. So there is a stretch I could do on this where you would see some filamentary structure.
But nothing in my talk was misleading.
Of course not.
Right. And of course, nothing in here is either. So we're all friends. So just to give you an order of magnitude here, and you can see it from even this plot. I don't even have to show this other plot. Here's the microwave background. You can see that the clusters, these little centers of light, are not so far off in peak flux from these splotches. They're a little bit brighter, but not hugely bright. And the peak of the CMB is something like 100 microkelvin. And so this, just from this alone, you're saying you can see the galaxy clusters at their peak would have a signal of several hundred microkelvin. That's sort of the order of magnitude we're looking at. So they are a big contrast if you can zoom in small enough. But as soon as you smooth over any interesting beam, you'll just see the microwave background. So we talked about that. So one of the big science goals for SBT was to try to characterize this Nagel-Dovich effect. And what is the reasoning for this? Well, so what this is four different mock catalog images where I took some halos, put some gas in them, said, look, how big is this Nagel-Dovich effect? This is sigma 8 of 0.6, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9, with all the other cosmological parameters fixed. And this is not so crazy. You know, this is probably something like the 2.5 sigma WMAP range or something like that. And what you see is that, and this is actually a linear stretch, so this is actually a fair image.
What's the WMAP central value?
It's about 0.7. 0.75, you know, something like that. And so what you see is that, so for sigma 8 of 0.6, there's basically nothing. 0.7, you're starting to see some interesting things. So this whole thing is I didn't say it's less than a degree on a side. It's a little bit smaller than the last graph. 0.6, 0.7, 0.8, 0.9. And so just by eye, you can do cosmology with this, right? If you see this, sigma 8 is high. If you see this, sigma 8 is low. And that's the level at which this stuff is almost 80-proof. Like sigma 8 of 0.6 to 0.9 is 80-proof.
Except you have to put your mask on.
Not even for this.
You do, sort of. I mean, one of the one on the upper right will look like the one on the upper left if you look at a lower mask.
Well, right. But so this is just the some unit of the central y parameter. And so this is 40-something. And so you can see you have a few things that are 40 in this. Down here, you're lucky to get any that are a factor of 2 low.
Yeah.
So it means that you would have to not understand your SD flux at a factor of 2 low.
No, I'm not saying you don't even know that you can't measure it to that well. I'm just saying that by eye,
well,
I mean, that just completely depends on the survey.
So I think that just from general considerations, you understand the mass of a cluster as it relates to the how bright it is and some of the anisotropics,
you
can have a factor of 2.
You can measure this for sure. I'm just saying
that the uncertainty of mass is sort of the difference between like these two things.
Yes.
Right, so it's called geometry under hyperbole.
Never mind.
So by eye, with a couple theorists around. Don't forget the theorists. Very important.
No, I'm sorry.
You need
but how much uncertainty is there? Obviously, going from Sinyanov-Zeldovich effect to mass is not assumption-free. How much room is there?
Right. So this is the problem. So when SPT got funded, I'll show you. There's actually a very simple physical argument. Just go forward. There. So there's a very nice, simple physical argument for why the Sinyanov-Zeldovich effect is idiot. And it's just that the effect is the integral, if you integrate over some big patch of sky, the central decrement. The central decrement is just the integrated pressures. You have nkt along the line of sight, it's dl, and then you integrate over a solid angle. You're integrating up the thermal energy, and it really is just nkt. Like, this is thermal energy. And then you have this 1 over dA squared, because if this cluster is really big, it's big on the sky. If it's nearby, it's big and it intercepts a lot of your photons. If it's far away, it hardly intercepts any. So it's redshift independent up to this factor right here. When people say this in the Sinyanov-Zeldovich effect is redshift independent, what they mean is that after you subtract out 1 over dA squared. So it's a little funny. However, this is 1 over dA squared. This is pretty clear, right? NKT, thermal energy, what could be... You know, anything else that you try to predict, galaxy luminosity, X-ray luminosity, is always proportional to some microphysics of some kind. You have thermal Bremsstrahlung, you have synchrotron, you have all sorts of weird things going on. This is total thermal energy. And this is on a scale, this is 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15 solar masses. And if you calculate how much energy that is, I should have written this one down. So it's something like 10 to the 11 supernovae. Something like that is how much energy you would have to be putting in to the cluster gas directly and have it stay there in order to actually be perturbing the thermodynamic system. So it's a huge amount of energy that you would have to dump into the gas, not have it radiate away. So galaxy clusters are so huge, there are these massive potential wells, it's very hard to come up with any physics that disrupts the global energy balance.
Wait a minute, there are many more stars in the...
Well, yes. But it's very hard to get that gas into
the supernova. The supernova, that's how much energy you have to have to wreck things? Is that what you're saying?
That's how much you would need to make a significant dent in the thermal balance of a galaxy cluster. You would have to take the entire energy of the supernova, like neutrinos and all, dump it into thermal energy in the gas, which is really hard to do. So, you know, you can't have a radiant.
I'm trying to figure out the sign of what you're saying. First of all, you're saying you need that many to see anything. I was like,
huh? Oh, no. That's how much you need to
right.
Because just the accretion shock heats you up to sign.
Yeah, but this is just a statement that the thermal energy of the cluster should behave in a self-similar way, right?
No, this is just a, well, this?
No, what you're saying right
what
now.
What I'm saying is that galaxy clusters are such a massive potential well that there are that all of the energetic things we see in the universe do not have enough energy to make any significant dent in the energy budget.
Right. I mean,
it has nothing to do with self-similarity or anything else. It's just saying that it's this massive amount of energy which we don't know how to compete with.
Yeah, but that doesn't really address Hub's question. I mean, because really what it gets to, no, because what you're saying is intrinsically you can't screw them up as badly.
Right.
But the real question is how well you know from measurements what it is
that
you
right.
have.
Right, because I thought that's a different question. I like your I'm about to say why this is also a problematic. Okay, why don't I let you go?
Yeah.
Let's go with this first, which is to say this is integrated number of electrons times kT. And the thing is the number of electrons turns out to be sensitive to things like how many of them you put in stars. Because
mm-hmm.
once they're in the stars, then they don't show up. So this is basically directly proportional to the fraction of baryons that you have locked up into stars, or 1 minus. So if you have some massively evolving amount of star formation, then you can really screw up this measure right here. And on top of that, the global thermal energy, so sure, this is very robust. You give me a potential, I drop gas into it. The global thermal energy I can reasonably well calculate up to this overall fraction of how much is in the gas. But there's not a one-to-one mapping between what the potential looks like and what the mass of the cluster is. Things look different as you vary the physics. So there's variations in how deep the potential well is for a given mass. Like there's intrinsic dispersion in cluster profiles such that mass is not the only parameter that defines clusters. And so all of these things conspire such that, so sure, there's an argument that this should be very simple, but if you actually look at it and you try to track down all the little bits of how much uncertainty there is, you end up with sort of slop at the level of 20-30%, which isn't bad. Like that's 20-30% if you don't really, you know, that's sort of what you're stuck with now, sort of at the limits of what we know. So this is stuff that should have been known 5 years ago, and in fact was known by anyone who really sort of thought about it very carefully. But this argument is so simple and compelling, right? And this is this quote about, for every complex phenomenon, there's this compelling, simple, elegant solution that's wrong. it's this very compelling argument that the Snyder-Dobek effect is so simple, but it turns out it's not quite as simple as you'd like. But just to sort of step back and get the big picture, right? So why could this be interesting? So everyone always says, cut launch parameters, don't we know this already? And what's the point? Now, the reason that it's interesting to study the late universe is because the CMB told us a lot about the early universe. So at redshift 1100, we know the physical conditions there are very, very well. We know the amplitudes, we know the sound arising, how much mass there was, we know all this stuff about redshift 1100. We know less about redshift 0. So obviously David's working on this. They're all slogging away, but you know, it's really hard to measure stuff nearby because we don't have anything that's as clean as the CMB. So this is, I took the WMAP chains, WMAP plus all and Markov chains. So this is basically the kitchen sink. You take everything we know about cosmology, assume that all the measurements are right, and take the constraints on parameters. These are the smallest parameter constraints you can get. So just the straight up lambda CDM. And I said, so let's say we knew the mass perfectly, so this mapping between flux and mass. And how many clusters does FPT expect? And so I did it for two different assumptions about what the mapping between the flux and the mass was. Sort of the red is a lower, is sort of a pessimistic view. The black is sort of what I think is probably reasonable. But what you see is that what you expect to see with SPT has a large dispersion. You have this factor of, 4 spread. And so basically your eye's roughly picking out the 1 sigma band here. This is sort of the way I plot
this. So do you assume that dispersion in mass flux relation?
No. So there's no dispersion in this. This is just straight saying, you know, how many things do we expect to see? And what you see is that there's something like a factor of 3, factor of 4, factor of something, dispersion within the allowed cosmological models of what the low redshift universe looks like. So factors of several uncertainty in something about cosmology is interesting. Right?
This is statistics, like cosmic variance issues, or is this
uncertainty changing omega mass?
This is just allowing all the cosmological parameters to flow and saying how many objects do we expect to see.
Okay.
Which, whenever you do this for anything else, turns out to be a very small range, right? You do this for supernovae, and they're already talking, you're at less than 10% variation value.
So, I mean, this is part of the point, is that this is very sensitive.
It's very sensitive to small changes in cosmological parameters, in particular.
Or another way.
So, that
good? Does that mean you can measure something?
Exactly.
Yeah, no, but I'm really confused. Because, no, hang on. I mean, is there any cosmological parameter apart from sigma 8 that contributes at all to
Well, sigma 8 is driving a lot of this.
I mean, it really is the normalization you get.
There is some omega matter in there as well.
Very.
Omega matter is actually not that well pinned down on the global scales.
But not factors of 4.
No. So it's way more sensitive to sigma 8 than it is omega matter.
But, I mean, this is totally doing testing. I bet if you plotted that with a fixed sigma 8, it would be like almost you couldn't
and
see
it. And I have plotted it that way. In
so this is a little... Well, no, I mean, you measure sigma 8, right?
What's wrong with sigma 8? What's wrong with measuring sigma 8?
Nothing. It's just that, I mean, if there's one parameter you're going to get, it's not that you're going to get all this cosmology.
No, but observations should be done if I take my counter stance on the dark energy task force. Experiments should be judged by how much of the W-map chain they rule out.
Yeah.
And he's going to rule out a lot of the W-map chain.
No, I'm not saying sigma 8 is not valuable. I think it is valuable.
Right.
I'm just saying that I think... The statement to make here is that the cosmology we can get here is dominated by sigma 8.
Yeah, I'd say it turns out to be a very precise probe of sigma 8.
Right.
But in general, it's a very strong test of cosmology in general.
Okay.
Right? I mean, this has to work. If this doesn't work, there's something off.
That's true.
And so the difference between the black and the red is telling you something about... knowing only what we know now about how bright we expect these things to be is a function of mass. This is sort of the dispersion. You can see that our current theoretical uncertainty is sort of is probably smaller than, but of the same order as the spread from cosmology. So, but this is something that's eminently fixable, and in fact, once you measure these clusters, you could actually look at them. They are more than just a point. These things have a size, they have X-ray flux, they have optical, they have galaxies in them. So you could actually look at these things, and in principle, you could remove most, at least, I would say, if you could reasonably get rid of more than half of this theory between the red and the black. So it is providing sort of a, there were very few tests of the growth of structure. In fact, I'd say there may be none.
But ISW effect.
Right. The ISW effect is the only thing we really have.
Tomography.
You're right, yeah. So lensing is the only one. And so there's sort of the only two ways of getting... So whenever we see these n-body simulations, you see these filaments form, they're in drain line with filaments, and you go, oh, wow, that's really great. And then after the simulation's over, they then put the galaxies down and pull out all the filaments, and you say, oh, that worked great. But there's nothing showing, giving any indication of this movie that's evolving. And so I would argue that that is actually the first, that is one of the strongest tests that CDM has not passed. It's the evolution.
It works well for the random walking flaws.
Yes, but that's in, yeah.
That's
true. It's in the
right. Range. Yeah, right. So Lyman alpha forest gives you another snapshot. You have a snapshot of redshift 3, you have redshift 1100.
2 to 4.
Oh, do you see the evolution?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's good.
It evolves, correct?
Right. Okay. So you see it from 2 to 4, you see it at 1100, we see it at 0. It'd be nice to fill that in.
You said this is the uncertainty due to cosmological parameters and then due to the theory. And then what the hope for SVP we'll get how many bins here and what error?
Oh, so this is a DMBZ for 0.04. So, you know, you take some bin that's 0.04, I don't know why I picked 0.04, but so let's say you come in here, there's some bin that's this wide, there's 100 clusters, it's a 10% error bar, basically the square root of n. So the error bar is, so across here, they've got from 0 to 2, they have, or we have 2 over 0.04 bins. And each one of them has error bars, which is going to be Poisson. So the Poisson, the error bar sort of that is roughly the hockey stick.
The narrow.
So you're going to get like 2,000 Poissons.
No, it doesn't work.
Yeah, something like that. So, you know, obviously exactly how many clusters you get has a huge dispersion. And it turns out that's one of the reasons we were doing this, is figuring out how to make sure that when we're doing SDT survey in the summer, that we had some number of interesting clusters in the survey. Because if you tune your scan design, you can end up getting actually almost zero clusters. You have small numbers. Right, so in principle, you can measure the dark energy. This is sort of the goal, but I'd say that we're nowhere near being able to do that. Right, so this is the whole issue that we've been talking about. Mapping between what you see and the theory. So the number you see is a function of redshift and flux. Is this thing right here, which is cluster physics, which we know almost nothing about, beyond at better than sort of the 20 or 30%. Currently, this is a theoretical problem in the sense that, and that's just not being solved very well. Here's the mass function. Here's all the cosmology. And so this is the part where all of the interesting cosmology is. This is where all the physics is, like the astrophysics of clusters. So this is where a lot of work needs to go in. And so we'll leave it at that.
So what can you say about dark energy in the antithing?
Well, so let's go back to here, right? So this is just from, say, sigma 8, right? And so what you can see is that the spread in this, and omega matter, but so what you see is the spread in here, here's the theory uncertainty, and it's something like a factor of 2, right? The central value is moved by a factor of 2. And I see no reason you couldn't drop that to be something like a 30% shift or a 20% shift. Like, I think that's probably something you could expect as being not unreasonable. Mm-hmm. And then here's sort of a similar thing. And here's just sort of Poisson scatter added to this black curve. And you can see if you have sort of a factor of this much that's coming from your theory uncertainty, it's going to be hard to really measure W very well.
Especially since you've normalized all those curves to agree at low redshift, but in fact you have variation you're allowed to do there.
That turns out to not be so bad. That's the least of the worries. I think that you could really sort of think of this as the spread out here, you know, compare that to this curve. Your theory uncertainty is this big. Even if you shrink that to be this big, since I kept the same scale, no. So this, and then you scale it, and you can see you're talking about W sort of, you know, I would say that that's an uninteresting level of W. But you're not doing anything interesting with W until you're telling the difference between these two curves.
Don't you learn more by including the actual masses, mass function?
Yeah. In principle, yes. So, you know, it all comes down to this. Like, how much can you shrink this down? It really does come down to how much can you shrink the difference between red and black? And if you can shrink it, so right now it's this big, if you could shrink it by a factor of, say, 10, you can cut the theory uncertainty by a factor of 10. And whether you do that by doing better theory or making more careful use of the observation, that's fine. But basically, this spread is how well do we understand how massive an object is that we see of some flux. For some object that has some SE flux, what's its mass? Right now, we're uncertain at a level that screws us like this. And so through some combination of observations and theory, if you can drop that by a factor of 10.
How much is that as an overall normalization? How much is, you know, differential and redshift, right? Because it's clearly the function of redshift, which is important to understand W, and the sigma 8 is sort of the overall normalization in some sense. So what are the major physical uncertainties that would affect the evolution?
So the main thing that affects the evolution is, I would say it's how much star formation there is as a function of redshift. Like, if you calculate the stellar mass in a galaxy cluster compared to the gas mass, does that vary strongly with redshift?
Or even ADN input, energy input, things.
So not on these scales, because it turns out to be a happy coincidence that because the SE effect is independent of redshift, you take some very long box, some very big, you know, so imagine you have a collection of clusters in this room, and then you pancake it. And then you look at them. It actually turns out that they start to overlap at around 10 to the 14 solar mass, which turns out to be a temperature of about 3 or 4 keV, which is right where all the cooling starts to really get interesting. So it turns out that the AGN feedback, so we see no evidence for AGN feedback doing anything interesting to clusters that you can see with the semantic logic.
Because they're more massive.
Because they're more massive, because they you get confusion limited. There's a seminal paper by this by Hogg about the confusion limit, which is that it's, there's something like 25 beams per source, you start to get confused. And if you take as your beam being a cluster being sort of the path of virial radius, then you get a source density of about 10 per square degree, is where they start to overlap, where you start to make serious errors.
Now, and so if you quantify, just to add a follow-on question that's sort of related, if you go out to the far end there, Richard, to 1.5, you've got a big offsetting number between W of minus 0.6 and minus 1, but because the mass function is steep, that's presumably a smaller systematic error in mass. So if you have a systematic error in your calibration from SF flux to mass, what does that difference turn out to as a number of percent? Is it a factor of a few, or is it in the tens of percent level?
Well, so in order to do interesting W science out here, you need to be measuring masses that's better than, say, 5%
systematically.
And so this is why you sometimes hear people say, oh, it's no problem, we'll do a cluster survey, and then we'll get weak lensing data to calibrate. Oh, no problem. We'll get 100, weak lensing.
At a redshift of 1.5?
Well, this is the thing, right? This, you say, oh, sure, that's no problem down here. But even then, let's say, if you want to get masses to better than 5%, that's systematically good, to better than 5% over this range in redshift. So, basically, in order to calibrate this cluster survey, you have to do a weak lensing survey, which is as good as the cosmic shear survey you need to do to measure the same thing to the same accuracy. So it's not clear you're winning anywhere. So it's not easy. But
we're only behind the clusters, right? So it's much
smaller. Oh yeah. So it's in terms of time and things like that, you only have to do. Although it turns out if you're actually following up something like SBT, you may as well just panel the whole sky and just do individual clusters. But the problem is the systematics. It's building an experiment that can do it and have careful control as a function of redshift. Like you want to make sure that your shear, the shear you measure as a function of redshift, doesn't have some tilt in it due to
uncertain redshift distribution.
Uncertain redshift,
for example.
Yeah.
That's probably the biggie.
But CMB lensing, is that's not
the problem. Oh yeah, you can do CMB lensing, but CMB lensing is tough. You can do it, yeah. I'll just say yes. You can definitely do it. Good luck. Okay, so let's see. So I have a few minutes left. So let's skip ahead. So there's astrophysics in the CMB. So this is the heating and cooling. Just to give you an idea, so someone asked about AGN feedback, and I said it didn't matter. And here's what I mean by it doesn't matter. So 0.85 degrees on the side, so here's with no feedback whatsoever. This is basically what you get if you were to run basically a dark matter simulation. Strong AGN feedback, here's different phases, but you can see by eye that something's different, right? It's not your eyes. There really is a difference. But I just told you that this doesn't matter. And the reason this doesn't matter is because what I was talking about was integrated flux. And the virial radius of this thing, so it's 0.85 degrees on the side, the virial radius of this thing is like this big. So you take this thing and you draw a circle and you calculate the average flux. You take this and you calculate the average flux. The thing that's causing this smearing is on a scale that's smaller than what you'd be interested in for calculating the total flux. So what it means is that the central SD decrement is a radical function of preheating, AGN feedback, supernova feedback, cooling, star formation, all these things we don't understand. So anything that is really sensitive to exactly how bright this central dot is really has to worry about these things. If you take some average over this thing, you do some further smearing, that's not quite so bad. And so that's the sense in which AGN feedback doesn't matter. In the sense that if you average over a large enough area, it doesn't matter.
So Reed and Spergel have a paper that claim that the central, I think this is very central Y parameter is insensitive to everything, basically. Have you seen?
It may be true that that's what their paper says, but that's empirically not true. Yeah. And then you can look at clusters and you can see things that look very similar at the same temperature. They have apparently the same mass and their central Y is very light vector. Amber is what it is, right? Back when you were at Chicago, we were looking at clusters that had spreads in central vector and thought that were effective, at least for things that were otherwise identical. Mm-hmm. So there's no way, so if your model predicts that, then your model is ruled out. It's possible that model's ruled out.
Well, and the other thing is that the central vector turns out to be not a very good.
Yeah, well, I understand.
Right? I mean, you really want to look at the integrated vector,
of course.
Right. But it's a non-trivial statement because one of the things that that points to is that you actually do see some clusters that look more like this and some other ones that look more like this.
Yeah.
And so there does seem to be some evidence that there actually is a strong dispersion in how much AGN feedback there is in clusters. And most people that are doing this sort of business of injecting energy into clusters assume there's some constant level from cluster to cluster, which seems to be not true.
Is there a mass dependence on that? Or? Like the most massive ones look like they have a lot of feedback and they learn stuff.
No, well, who knows? it's only sort of looking now like there may be some scatter. So whether that scatter is a function of mass, once we have 10,000 clusters, 2,000 clusters from FBT, we can start answering questions. But at this point, we just don't have enough data. So are radio galaxies a problem? No. Oh, here's one of my favorite thoughts. I'm actually going to spend a minute on this. So there's a fantastic paper by Herbig and Rehek from 1992, and there's about six or seven pages in a row which are just spectra of radio galaxies. And you always think that radio galaxies are these very interesting, very flat, uninteresting things. And a common thing that's done is you go down to some frequency, like a gigahertz, and you calculate the slope of the line along here. And then you extrapolate it up or down, whichever way you want to go. And sometimes that works really well. Sure, some radio sources are power laws. Some are gently varying power laws. Some of them are nothing like a power law, right? Some of them are very flat. Some of them fall. So you can see there's this very diverse population. Some of them are variable, so some of them will look like that. Like this one right here has two different fluxes at the same frequency. That's not a mistake. That means it's varying at the level of a factor of two. Someone looked at it, they went back and looked again, it was a factor of two off. These things are fascinating objects. But when you're trying to do a CMB experiment, they're a huge pain in the ass. And so one of the reasons that that a lot of cluster stuff has moved up to high frequencies, so 150 gigahertz, is specifically to get away from these radio sources. So these are radio frequencies, these are typically gigahertz. And you see a typical source goes like this. So if you go do all your measurements at 100 gigahertz out here, the radio flux should be way down compared to if you're doing your measurement down here. You can get a factor of 10 just by going to higher frequencies. So that's sort of a reasonable thing to do. But then what some people have said is, hey, wait a second, what about these objects? Aren't these objects going to be a problem? And the answer is yes, those ones are being screwed. They're going to be very bright out here, and there's nothing you can do about it.
But in terms of temperature, they're still falling.
Yeah, so this is in flux in Jansky. So in temperature units, you get sort of a factor n mu squared. But the real things that get you are ones that if this didn't turn over, if it just kept on going all the way up, then you would really be in trouble. And this is what people have worried about. And it turns out they aren't too much of a problem. Okay, but there's one thing I want to talk about. So, fine scale CMB amplitude. So, you're all used to seeing the CMB power spectrum plotted at a much lower L. So, here's L of 2000. And so, we're way out in the damping channel. We've zoomed in on that one part of the plot, and there's the primary CMB. Way out here. So, this is actually a simulation of the SBT pipeline that Tom Crawford did, just to see how well SBT will measure the CMB. And all the way out, so remember that very first plot I showed that has the primary CMB and then the secondary is kicking in at high L? This is that top curve, the thermal SD. So where it crosses, you see that you're still just nailing. Look at that little itty bitty error bar. So this is what I mean by primary CMB stuff is really about to be just nailed by all these big experiments. And then it comes down here, and then so what happens is this thing sort of turns up, and what's happening is that there's residual thermal SE subtraction issues, there's these point sources killing you. Here is this KSE signal, or the Ostreicher-Vishniac, or the Vishniac. This is the Thomson scattering. And it's down here. And so this is what people want to measure. So ACT, for instance, has a sensitivity level which is down more like this. And that's partly because one of their science goals is to measure this dotted line. But look at all these other things that are coming in at the same level. This is just noise that's getting in the way. So you can see that measuring this signal is going to be very, very hard.
So that residual, yes, what is that?
That's point sources.
Oh, so how do you compute the residual?
So this is, so what's done? So basically what happens is you make a map, you basically subtract, project out all the point sources that you can. So you can actually see them. You have multi-frequency stuff. So you can actually measure them at the high frequency and subtract them out. But there's some uncertainty in the spectral index of the point sources. And so that's what's coming in here, is sort of the uncertainty in how well you can subtract out these point sources and not affect your CME. And the same thing with the residual thermal SE, things are sort of helpful.
But there must be ways you can make orthogonal measurements on a CME once you know the locations of the point sources.
Well, except that the point source that we're talking about have a density that's approaching one per pixel. But basically, at these flux levels, almost every arc minute has a some sort of an infrared point source. There are these scuba sources, which you see in the submillimeter. And these things turn out to have a density which is high enough that these CME experiments should be able to see a huge fraction. So if you were to mask out everything that had a point source in it, you would not have much cluster. You would not have much map. So that's a bit of a problem. However, you can see that you are nailing all of this CME out past LF 2000. The CME is being very accurate for you. And so one of the things you can do with this, if you want to go back to doing sort of parameter estimation, one of the things that it really will do well on is things like the running of the spectrum. You want to measure the matter power spectrum. You can measure the running very well. You can really nail the actual tilt in the spectrum as well. So if you take WMAP and combine it with SPT, you can do very, very well. And that's just because you have this long lever going all the way up to LF2000.
Does this include all this kind of mapping issues and stuff like that?
Okay, no, definitely it doesn't. So this curve right here says, well, maybe we shouldn't trust things that are below LF30 because there's some funny business in the CMB at LF30 with the polarization. So some of this is saying don't trust the low L polarization at the same level. So I know this. So the problem is if you just sort of put in, if you do a simple signal noise estimate, WMAP is unbelievably good at low L and polarization. And so you have to figure out some way to de-weight that because it's not nearly as good at low L as you would think it should be.
Right, it's basically some fog on sentences.
Yeah.
And you saturate that.
Yes. That's exactly true. Now, so the map making issues, though, that's not included, but the map making issues at high L for SPT are not too bad.
You can do CME to start on the point.
Yeah. Right. So the map making issues for SPT are an issue at the L of a few hundred.
Okay.
Yeah. So at L of a few hundred SPT, you should probably be a little. You may only trust.
So how does this compare to
the
minor
alpha
for
us? Oh, I'm not fat. Well, it's a lot better than the current ones. Right. But how would it compare to 2 years from now? Still better?
I think it's
about.
Okay. Another question was, how does it compare to?
Oh, yeah, it turns out that basically SPT does almost exactly the same as Planck in almost every, in things like this.
Python?
Yeah. And that's
when was things just current finance and Planck that you can run, because you have the scale like 4th, it's big, it's just so good.
Well, I mean, essentially what you're doing is you measure the primary power spectrum until it dips into all these other effects.
But it's not all sky, right? It's not all sky, right? So it's six times more sky.
Yeah, but it doesn't make any difference because you're talking about small scales. And as long as you connect your small scales to the larger scales one way or another.
Well, it's a sample variance thing. If your sample variance limited all the way up, then the ratio of errors is basically the square root of your sky coverage.
So if Planck's sample variance limited all the way to L of 2000,
then it would be the case that Planck is the square root of 6 better in error bar. So that's a factor of 2. But they're not sample variance limited all the way up to L of 2000.
Right.
This looks about right for Planck.
So basically, what we were finding is that anything you do, WMAP plus SPT, turns out to be annoyingly the same as Planck.
Well, makes perfect sense.
So unless Planck blows up, then. But this will be our first.
And it's cheaper.
And it's cooler, right? It's
colder.
10 meter telescope in the South Pole.
Yeah.
Cooler, of course.
Okay, so there's one last thing. I'm going to skip the stuff my grad student did. So let's skip to the punchline. The benefits of alien collaborators are registered 10. So imagine this. Imagine you have a collaborator, registered 10, who has sent you a signal. He said, my CMB quadrupole is 35 microkelvin. And you write that down. And then you have another one over here who has sent you a signal and said, my CMB quadrupole is 35 microkelvin. So you have an array of collaborators.
Should we be broadcasting this information now?
Mm-hmm. We are.
Are you an alien?
Right.
No, I have to help other aliens.
Like other aliens are checking your email. Right? Everything you've sent over the wireless is being read by
aliens. Oh, including whatever I mentioned the CMB part.
Yes. Exactly. They have astro pH. Like everyone who pulled down a paper over astro pH, that has been broadcast.
Okay.
Right? Because they all have huge telescope. So imagine you have all these people telling you what their CMB is. So that's a huge amount of information that's actually independent of what you're measuring. And the reason for that is that our CMB is measured here. This is the surface of last scattering. We have galaxy surveys. Let's say they go at redshift 2. We're measuring stuff in here. All of the CMB skies that these people at redshift 10 are measuring are probing this region in here, which half of which is actually between a redshift of 1100 and 10, which is where we have no information and probably never will. So if you had some array of collaborators who have sent you all their signals, then this would be a way to actually map out the Hubble volume over much of the Hubble volume. So basically you, in principle, get the sphere with a little tiny core in the middle, which is the stuff from redshift after redshift 2. And you're getting a snapshot of what the universe was like at a redshift of 1100 over this entire volume, which is pretty neat. And the thing is that there is a way to actually get some of this. And the reason for this is that reionization happened in a patchy way. There are little blobs where you get some little ionized region. And that shows up as extra Thomson scatter. And that scatters the quadrupole. Polarization is the scattered quadrupole. And so what that means is that if you make a very high resolution CMB polarization map, the optical depth fluctuations during reionization in some simulations, so at least in alien simulations, you get optical depth fluctuations which are of order 1%. And that is the optical depth through a galaxy cluster. It's a huge amount of scattering that's going on. And so in principle, you get sort of 1% fluctuations in the polarization all over the place. And every one of those little fluctuations is telling you the amplitude and direction of the CMB quadrupole at that point. And so over reionization, you get a superposition of these sources. So if you could map out what the optical depth fluctuation is, which you can, because someday we'll have 21 centimeter measurements, which are telling you where all the holes are in the distribution. So you have a map of the electron column, and well, the fluctuations in the electron column. You have a map in the optical of the polarization, you compare these two things, and what you'll get is you get a measure of the quadrupole all over the place. So you do this at a bunch of different spots in the sky, you do it as a function of redshift. So throughout reionization, you get sort of a little bit of resolution this way, so that gets you a little extra information. So in principle, you can actually get this whole array of quadrupole measures. So it's not perfect, but you can see, so for instance, this is the 21 centimeter brightness fluctuation, this is the optical depth, and you can see there's a very strong intercorrelation. Red, blue, blue, red, blue, red. It's very strongly anticorrelated.
So what is the radius of mass scattering surface at realization?
That big. So reg of 10, this is co-moving distance. So basically it's roughly half of our serviceable scatterings. Something like that, right? And so that's cool, right? You can do all sorts of fun stuff with this. And so one thing you could do is you could actually look for all these weird correlations. So the whether there's these axis of evil and this other stuff. Yep.
So the 1% variation comes from for that whole outer annulus for the integrated over the sort of the whole line of sight for the radially through the annulus.
Well, the 1% fluctuation is coming from a bubble right here. So basically, there's a bubble right here, which would be maybe this big. There's a little bubble. But the universe is so dense at a redshift of 10 that the contrast of an ionized bubble with the neutral stuff around it is huge, because the density is bigger by a factor of 1,000. So if you're overdense, so you get this huge contrast relative to the background, which can be 1%. A fully ionized region that's a few megaparsecs co-moving.
Do you typically have one bubble along one radius? One
well, so there's some. There's going to be some distribution, right? There's going to be a brightest bubble, and then there's going to be some distribution of bubbles. So there will always be some bubble size. You're only going to see one, and it does turn out that for the most part, you're dominated by the biggest bubble. What you see in the map is the biggest bubble. And so you can do all sorts of things. The other thing you can do is you could actually, if you had a galaxy to 3, you could actually reconstruct the initial conditions of that region. Redshift 1100. So you can see the end result and actually have some hope of doing some, say, here's the initial condition, here's what ended up there, what happened.
Right, that's Bata Veselic. It's like these things where you have a reflection of an event.
Exactly.
It's very similar.
Exactly.
Do you learn anything comparable from waiting and watching the CMB change? Like, if we wait for a million years or something, we'll start to see changes on this.
This is what Lyman Page did recently.
I don't know.
There are a couple papers on it. So they're about 3 months, 4 months behind us for PhD.
A lot more than that.
So that stuff you mainly just learn about the damping tail. Because basically, it's still the case. And so there's some finite thickness of last scattering, and that moves from being here to being here. Oh, sorry, it moves the other way. You go back a little bit. And so it's a very small lever. So basically, it's the same sort of thing, except you're going back in time and moving this thing around. So we're not always stuck at being in the center. So in principle, it could work. Now, the problem is if you want to really map this out properly, you need sort of 0.1 micro-K on arc minute scales and polarization, which means you need the collection area, basically ALMA. So ALMA could do this in principle. It has a collecting area. But it's not really optimal for it. And you need sort of millikelvin redshift at 21 centimeters, which turns out to be the full SK. So if you wanted to actually do the map, you need stuff that is not about to be, we're not in the process of making these measurements.
How big is sky?
Well, so this map is something like a degree. And so in a degree, you get fluctuations that are this. So basically, any patch that's a degree, you should see something that's that big. So anywhere you point your telescope, you should be able to see one of these.
But from the 21 centimeter, you get a ridiculous number of planes along the line of sight. You measure each one independently, and then even though all the effects from those in the correlation have almost canceled out, you're just getting whatever residual.
But the polarization just adds.
It
averages down as you get many different bubbles. And so what you need is you get a high contrast bubble. Oh, yeah, it's not going to be easy.
It's hard, but you get a lot.
But you get a lot, and there's no other way to get this information.
But what do you actually get?
The initial conditions of every galaxy in the shell.
So.
Okay, right. Yeah. So it's a philosophical question whether this is actually useful or not. From a pure signal to noise perspective and parameter fitting,
yeah,
you actually
awesome.
Don't get very much. From pure signal noise, you don't get very much, but it's kind of it's pretty weird, right? Mapping out the entire spherical Hubble volume. Oh, redshift 1100.
I love mapping things for the sake of mapping things.
You can maybe constrain realizations of our actual universe.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so I've ran over. So I'm going to end it right here. And so as I take questions, you can stare at this as Olivier's plot. And it's one of my favorite plots in the whole wide world. And the reason for this is because this is the polarization signal, Q and U. And this is for that same simulation, or well, not the same simulation, but it's a comparable thing. This is the Q map. This is the U map. So Stokes Q and Stokes U, or Stokes Q, Stokes U. And it has, and what's happening is the axes have been chosen so that almost all of the reionization power is showing up in the U map. And what you see is you see what B modes and E modes are. E modes have this sort of cross shape power, and the B mode has this nice grid. And I'll stop there.
So here's what I heard. The best thing that you're going to get out is NS and sigma 8.
From SPT,
yeah.
Right, and that NS and sigma 8, those are easy. And everything else I've talked about is really hard.
So we can just start early.
I guess I could have slimmed this
down. Yeah, well, I think instead of going and having another talk now, I think we're going to just... go ahead and go to lunch now, and then try to reconvene at 2, and then we'll have Pat start at 2, rather than having Dan start at 2:30, if that's okay with people. I mean, because Justin's not here. So,
we have to.
And is it, it's reasonable to just leave our...
Yeah, well, you can leave our stuff here, because in the afternoon we're going to start up. We're going to go, we're gonna go upstairs.
Anyway, so.
But yeah, you can leave your stuff here.
It looks like that.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure Avi Loeb went over around
2000. Yeah.